Larry Mitchell. In his home, and it is January 23rd. We'll be talking about workplace integration, something out of our project that I'm working on. Wade, let's start off with you, if you will, and give me a little background of where you were born, raised, and school.
I was born right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to the Atlanta Public Schools.
All right, let's stop right there. Okay, Wade, if you will, let's continue. You, Georgia Tech.
Right, born in Atlanta, went to the Atlanta Public Schools through high school and then to Georgia Tech. Graduated from Georgia Tech in June of 1957. Served 2 years in the Navy. Then went 2 years to graduate business school.
Where was that?
Went to the Harvard Business School.
Okay.
After the Navy. Got out of the business school and went to work for West Point Manufacturing Company in West Point, Georgia, where I worked for a little less than a year.
Textiles.
I was a textile major at Georgia Tech. My father had been in the textile machinery sales business. I was in West Point for a little less than a year.
Okay. Familiar with West Point Pepperell. I did an outplacement down there, so I spent quite a few months down there. What was your responsibility there?
I was their first management trainee.
Okay.
So I was there to rotate through various departments, mills, and try and begin to build a base to learn the business.
Right. What period of time would this be?
This would have been probably June of 1961. I came after I left there. After about 11 months, I came back to Atlanta and took a job with then Trust Company of Georgia in June of 1962.
Okay. All right. At West Point, they were probably completely segregated down there. Or tell me, were there many blacks in the management at the end of that?
I think it would be safe to say that there were none in the management end of it. And I don't really remember that many blacks even in the production end of the business.
Okay.
It was pretty much a lily white society as I remember.
Well, that was fairly typical all over the South at that time. But now, when you went to work for the trust company, what was your job?
My starting job again was as a trainee.
Okay.
In the credit department, where I stayed for several months trying to learn some of the tools of the trade before they put me out in the field to do business.
Okay. Tell me about your job since you moved along.
I was probably 6 months or thereabouts in a training capacity, and then went to work in the National Accounts Division. We had responsibility for the banking business that we had or would like to have from companies who had some presence in Atlanta but whose headquarters were located elsewhere. So, my responsibility was for the eastern half of the country, from the Mississippi over.
Okay.
Most of that time spent in the large metropolitan areas on the East Coast,
and
New York,
Boston. Tell me again what you were doing on those trips.
I was soliciting business for the trust
companies,
banking business, deposit, loans, conventional commercial banking business.
tell me what you remember about blacks at that time. Did you encounter or do business with anybody in management, those companies?
No, certainly not at that point. At that point, it was totally white. And most of the lower level jobs, even.
Okay. Then what was your next job? Didn't you get into human resources at some point?
I did. I worked for about 3 years in the National Accounts Division. Then I went as manager of our Buckhead branch, where I was in the retail end of the business for another 3 years. And I guess made the mistake of complaining too much about our human resources, or then it was called the personnel function.
Personnel, yeah.
And so they said, okay, smart guy, you go fix it. So I went back downtown from Buckhead in probably 1968 or thereabouts to run the then personnel department of Trust Company.
Well, how long and then what?
It sounded like I was on a 3-year program, but I was the head of personnel for 3 years. And then they asked me to head up the operations support for the bank, which was all of the back office accounting, data processing functions at the bank.
Okay.
And stayed there for 3 or 4 years and then came back in the last years at then SunTrust, where I had responsibility for administrative services, which was a grab bag of things from real estate to personnel, legal, to purchase, to security. A lot of things nobody else wanted to do.
Well, at that point, were you executive vice president?
Yes.
Right. Let's go back to when you first started with the trust company. The trust company was one of the first plans for progress companies based on sign created an affirmative action plan. This would have been 61, 62, probably before we got there. Did you find that you were working with blacks in white collar jobs when you first got there, or was it a little bit later?
No, it really, it was later. And my involvement with the affirmative action programs and efforts to hire and integrate blacks into the workforce really didn't happen until I went as head of personnel.
And
that would have been about 1968 or thereabouts. So I was late coming to that game.
That's right. Jim Ray was the representative of the trust company with the Atlanta Marriage Department Association, and I had personal contact with Jim. And he had a PhD in something.
Yeah, he was a smart guy. I mean, really, really smart.
I was
smart
surprised
guy.
That he was into the personnel part of it.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what his PhD degree was in, probably psychology, but he was a big numbers guy and very analytical, quantitative. He and I worked together a good bit.
Well, do you know who was writing the affirmative action plans at the time that you got personnel responsibility? Or let's put it this way, when you came in, there was a need to update annually.
Yeah, we were really just beginning to hire late as 1968 when I came in. We had a few blacks in lower level clerical jobs. We had never hired any blacks for the training program and management jobs. And that was one of the efforts that I was involved in early after I got there, was recruiting on black campuses and trying to Atlanta University complex, Alabama A&M.
Tennessee A&M.
I never made a trip to Tennessee.
In Florida. Some of those technical schools and not engineering schools. We only recruited in hockey for engineering. Mm. So we had no food applications for it. Well, who on your staff would actually do recruiting? Remember that?
I worked with Mose Bond.
Okay.
And Vic Gregory.
Vic Gregory.
We handled most of the on-college campus recruiting. We had a few interviewers on the staff who would interview local applicants. We did most of the college recruiting.
I recall Vic Gregory, he was your representative on the Atlanta American Bar Association.
Right.
And helped with the youth motivation program. As I recall, the trust company, as you got into blacks with non-traditional jobs, white collar jobs, and you provided motivators to be participating in the annual youth motivation days and stuff going on.
Right. Vic was very much involved.
He was all very involved. Well, as you got moved along, and started putting more and more blacks in non-traditional jobs. Do you have any memories of how that went over with management?
Well, we were, by the time that I got involved, we were pretty much under the gun, if you will, to hire blacks to satisfy economic EEOC,
yeah,
whatever those initials stand
Equal
for.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission,
yeah.
That's the enforcement agency.
Yeah, they,
but there was also, I think, trust companies, probably a federal contractor.
Yeah, we were a federal contractor, and as a federal contractor, they was subject to the EEOC regulations, OFCC.
Two enforcement agencies.
Right.
You were subject to annual, periodic.
Excuse me just a minute.
That's always been confusing, and there's so many acronyms. The Office of Federal Contract Compliance was the had oversight responsibility for the compliance of federal contractors with the Executive Order 10925 promulgated by President Kennedy all the way back in 61. So you were subject to the same kind of compliance reviews that we were.
Right.
And the compliance officers came out and made a tour, I'm sure, of your offices as they did our plant, and then met with me at Lockheed, and who you had responsible for writing the affirmative action plans. They were there to monitor and see that you had sufficient affirmative action ongoing to aggressively hire and place blacks in non-traditional jobs. So I think it is accurate to say you're under the gun. We were under the gun, too.
Right.
But how we did it, and this is the point we're going to make in this history, is that we did it. I mean, nobody did it for us. And it was just a question of whether we'd made a genuine good faith effort. And that's all you were required to do, is to make a good faith effort. We had no quotas, and I don't imagine you did either.
No quotas as such that I remember, but I do know that they looked very closely at your progress.
Right, correct.
And how many more you had in what level jobs and what those jobs were. There was that pressure to do it, and it might or might not have gotten done without that pressure. I think we had people of goodwill running that company who wanted to do the right thing, but as I'm sure you know, it was not easy to identify the talent that you wanted and to convince them that there was an opportunity for them to apply those talents in your organization. It was an uneasy partnership, but I think probably progress was made faster than it might have been made otherwise if that encouragement from the examiners hadn't been there.
No doubt, and I think it was also true at Lockheed. We were required by the regulations to create an affirmative action plan that dealt with underutilization of blacks, and that was relative to the job market, the labor market, and that was the problem that I think you were referring to convince them, those that you felt were qualified, to apply and try to get into the system. Then you probably had management to deal with there too, to make sure that they were making a fair evaluation of the candidates that the recruitment process produced.
Right.
Is that?
No question.
It was not easy.
No.
And you mentioned that, and and that's what I keep thinking about and saying as we study the history here. When we went made all this statistical progress, for example, we started with one affirmative action plan and ended up with 441 nationally, but that didn't mean that every one of those companies was going to move at the same speed. There were a lot of conditions and situations. Now, did you to deal with management attitudes and understanding of the obligations of the bank, did you have training programs for management on this? Sometimes it would cause sensitivity training programs.
We had a few sensitivity training programs. We would have consultants come in and lead us through some exercise. Some of the consultants were good and some of them not so good, and some of them probably set the cause back as much as anything. But yes, we had a training program to do of our own people as well as the candidates that we were hiring.
Okay. How would you describe the purpose of those training programs?
I guess it was primarily just to ask people to examine their own attitudes and to understand that it was important, and it was not only the right thing to do, but it was important to the business that we find a way to begin to employ blacks in jobs throughout the organization.
Okay. At some point, the matter of the bank's addressing black investors and people that and came to the trust company for service. So, do you recall when you had branch banks in the black community that?
Well, we had early on branch locations in primarily black communities. We were in East Atlanta. That was one of our first branches. We were in West End with a branch.
And what period of time would that have been?
Well, these were early branches, so...
That was before you got there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, those branches were
all right,
in existence. But there was a pressure to serve the community as a whole and to bring services that would be conveniently available to the black population.
You say pressure. Would that be outside or inside pressure? Was that management's desire to do that because it's the best interest of the bank, or did they
Again, I think it was a mixture of the two. Community activists wanted the bank's presence in their community, and they made that known. Mm-hmm. And again, I think that the senior management of the bank were, for the most part, well-intended people who wanted to do the right thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, did you have black management people in those banks, branches?
Yes, the managers of those branches at some point were...
Approximately what point would that be? Would that before you got there or after you got there?
I think that was certainly after I got there.
Okay.
I would say we were beginning to put blacks in management positions in those branches probably 68, 69, 70, somewhere in that time.
Okay, very good. I want to ask you about the culture that existed throughout the South as we integrated. It was clear by 1968 and 70 that discrimination was banned, particularly for federal contractors to be subject to compliance reviews, and they do investigations. And also the EEOC is another enforcement agency, and employees could file charges of discrimination, which were investigated. But I want to ask you about your recollection of the attitudes of management and the customs and the attitudes of blacks and customs. This would include complaints that your staff had to handle on discrimination and the management's response to that. Could you help me with that?
Well, cultures, as you know, are slow to change, and so even after we began to hire blacks in some numbers, I think that there was an uneasiness on the part of white supervisors in dealing with black employees. I would think that they maybe we had oversensitized them, but they were they tended to be super cautious and careful in disciplining black employees. In our cafeteria, there was some integration of the black and white people at the lunch hour, but again, for the most part, the blacks ate with other blacks and the whites ate with other whites. It was the exception rather than the rule to see a truly integrated group at a lunch
right.
table.
How long did that exist?
I think it probably still exists.
Well, you did.
I'm not down there on a continuing basis, but I go occasionally, and it seems to me that most of the blacks are sitting with other blacks, mm-hmm. with a sprinkling of blacks in with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand what you're saying, and I have similar experiences too. And our study shows that it cultures are not changed by laws, period. They're changed by people and their attitudes. And you told me how the bank had training programs to assure that management at all levels understood the obligation to treat blacks equally and give them a chance and to promotions and pay increases and all of that, and not treat them separately as a black. We all worked on that, and that took a long time for us, and I think you're confirming what my study indicates existed elsewhere. Cultures are very, very slow to change, but the workplace integration is a place where people have to work to get together to get the job done, and there is a sense of has been in at Lockheed and according to the scholarly literature that I have at hand, workplace bonding did occur when people had to deal with each other to get a common task done. Did you sense any of that?
Yes, I had the privilege of working with several very, very well qualified, productive blacks.
Okay.
They were people that got the job done and you really relied on. So I'm not saying it didn't happen, but it didn't happen as quickly or as universally as any of us would like to have seen.
How about your experience with your black branch managers? Were they...
Some of them were good, some of them not so good.
Well, the ones that are not so good probably were subject to discipline or lack of pay increases or maybe being transferred. If I understand the free enterprise system, we can't we can't tolerate non-performance very long. Tell me about that. Now, did you have any instances where black managers had to be removed, supervised?
We did, and we always did it very carefully, because at this time, the black population had access to a representative
grievance procedure, non-union grievance procedure.
It really wasn't available or not utilized by the white employees.
Right.
So there was a difference in the way that we dealt with them because nobody wanted an EEOC suit.
Charge of discrimination. Do you recall any?
We had some of those.
You did.
More than I would like to remember. The white employee that you disciplined and charged didn't have this sort of an organization or not organization, but avenue available to them.
They had a built-in complaint procedure with the EEOC and also more so than the OFCCP.
Absolutely.
And you were a non-union organization.
Right.
So this was probably more strange, this complaint's more strange than it would be to a company like Lockheed that was unionized.
You were used to it.
I worked first 8 years in labor relations and dealt with grievances and represented the company in arbitration cases. So when it came time for me to be responsible for equal employment opportunity, I was conditioned to complaints. Now, I have to say this, and I ask you how your management, But the management at Lockheed, and often, not generally, but frequently, were resentful of charges of discrimination.
Absolutely. Nobody likes complaints.
And so when we went down to investigate along with the government, we were not very welcome. In fact, that was a joke. One of the managers that I knew very well, the production manager, says, "Here comes the EEO, whatever you call it." I was looked at as almost as an outsider.
Oh, yeah.
But I had explained to him that I'm here to get the facts just like the government's getting facts. And if this goes to court, then I will be representing Lockheed and you. So keep that in mind and cooperate with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to use those kind of tactics. I don't know how you dealt with management there.
Very similar.
You had to really sort of read the riot act to them that we're really looking to get things solved here in a fair manner. And it's just that simple.
No question.
one of the wind a little bit. One of the things that we're studying is the effect of workplace integration on attitudes and the cultures that existed going back to Jim Crow days, where blacks were had very little and whites had very little contact with each other. And in workplace integration, there was a lot of contact on a daily basis. Now, as time went on, blacks apparently proved themselves to management that they were qualified to hold a higher level job. And like any promotions, you're always on trial. let's talk about this, if you would. When you did promote a black or blacks into more responsible management jobs, you did, I shouldn't say you did, you looked at whether or not they could manage mixed groups. Would you tell me how you felt about that, or what you recall about that? That's a judgment call, I understand.
Sometimes we met with very good success, and our judgment proved to be true, mm-hmm. that these people that had been promoted could in fact function and function very well. And I guess it, you know, all goes to what the experience was. If you had a good experience,
mm-hmm.
great, you know, everybody's really happy about that. If you have made a misjudgment or for whatever reasons it doesn't work out, then the attitude of some who might not have been so ready to accept the integration were hardened to some degree, and it just made it more difficult going forward. I would come back to the comment that we tended to be very careful and maybe too cautious in judging performance, because we knew that if you had a situation where you needed to remove someone that you had promoted, that was going to be a signal that was heard throughout the organization.
Right.
And there'd be some who would say, "Well, I told you that it wasn't going to work out." it was not easy.
Try to recall the highest levels of responsibility of blacks in your tenure at the bank?
We had some senior credit folks who had come up through the ranks who were black. In the personnel human resources area, we had a very had a couple of very, very competent, well qualified, productive employees.
Were they managers?
They were managers.
Did you have a personnel manager that was black?
Never a personnel manager, but head of our recruiting or interviewing group, head of our compensation and benefits.
Oh, really?
Group.
That would be a manager job, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Manager of benefits.
Well, not so much a manager of large numbers of people, a small staff, but a lot of responsibility for dealing with other managers.
I think it's fairly typical. I was compensation manager at Lockheed at one time. And you have very small staff, with a lot of responsibilities invested in
big impact,
and a few people that have responsibility for making recommendations to senior management on benefits and salaries and that sort of thing. So you had blacks in that position?
We did.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Now, did you recall hiring blacks into management from other banks?
No.
Did you hire any from the...
I'm sure they have done that in recent years, but we were starting from ground zero, so we were not cherry-picking.
Right. When did you leave the bank? 1993. Mm-hmm. Okay. If we looked at race relations on a scale of 1 to 10. And back in the mid-20th century, and even as late as the late 50s, in 1960, in the South, our history indicates that very few blacks in non-traditional jobs, all throughout the South. And Atlanta, you would think the gem city of the South would be ahead, and they were, because Lockheed was ahead in the 50s, but then the rest of the community moved up a big notch in 1961 and 62 when we formed the Atlanta Merit Employment Association. And in that period of time, companies moved together in ways that they would not have moved separately, but it still was slow, but it was very significant. So if you look at the Jim Crow days, I guess on a scale of 1 to 10, it's hard to say that we even won because there were negative attitudes. Now, how would you say at the trust company in terms of that? Of course, you arrived after the whole process had started, but how would you evaluate that change? What I'm asking and seeking to determine is the progress that was made in race relations, however you want to go, the ease in which blacks and whites worked together, change in management's evaluation of what blacks could do for the bank, more responsibility. And over a period of time, certainly there was change there. Would you help me to evaluate that change?
Yeah, of course, I am 13 years out of it now, and I'm sure that they have been changes, hopefully positive changes in that time, but I would say during my time from, say, 1966 to 1975, we may have moved from a 1 to a 5, which is pretty good progress, but with a lot of progress left to be had.
Our history project is concentrating on 3 decades, 50s, 60s, and 70s. So how would you say that it came from you say maybe in 1968 it was a 1. How was it in 1980?
I'd say that's the time frame I would be looking at from, say, 68 to 80. I'd say it moved from a 1 to a 5.
Okay.
Which is pretty substantial progress, but there's a whole lot of progress left to be made, too.
Well, it's 500%.
Yeah.
There's nothing really to look at. I don't think any of us in a management sense would ever admit that, it was very high. We always had a challenge. I think that's what you're saying.
Sure.
You left a big challenge for your successors, but you got it started. How do you feel about that? What you accomplished?
Well, I don't feel like I was any standard bearer or breaker, but I felt good that we had made a good faith effort and had moved the standard a good ways upward.
Okay.
Like I say, I had some very, very positive experiences personally in dealing with blacks that we hired and seeing them succeed in higher paying, more responsible jobs. I feel good about that.
Well, I think you have a right to. It was not easy, as we talked earlier. How about other banks, your competitive banks, so to speak? Do you have any feel for what they were doing?
I think we were pretty much in lockstep. I don't think that we were much different from the other major Atlanta banks. Mm-hmm. We were in pretty close communication and contact, and we were all headed in the same direction, and I think at about the same speed.
One of the major manifestations of integration is your tellers, right?
Yeah.
They're out front.
Now, the most underappreciated job all of captivity.
Oh, really?
I think so. I think, the teller is the face of the bank to the public.
Right.
And they're on the firing line and subject to the abuse, if you will, of unhappy customers, and not all customers are happy. So they've got the balance to the penny at the end of the day, and they got to keep all those people that they have face-to-face contact with, if not happy, at least not in revolt. So I think they've always had a very, very difficult
Now,
job.
You started with a trust company in what, 66?
62.
62?
Yeah. I started in the human resources area primarily.
All right, well, let me ask you your recollection of when, at what period of time did you have black tellers?
We probably had our first black tellers in small numbers in 67, 8, 9, somewhere along in there.
Okay.
Now you go into a retail branch, and most of the tellers are black, and that demonstrates a lot of progress, but again, I'm sure is a problem too, because the teller job is still regarded as a fairly low level job, when I think it is grossly underappreciated.
Was it a stepping stone job?
It can be a stepping stone job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the percentage is, but I go into trust company or SunTrust branch is now, doesn't matter where the branch is, Buckhead, Northside Drive.
Okay. Blacks.
They are almost...
Almost
all,
solid black.
All black.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anytime you got a workforce that's all white or all black, that's not good.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see. You and Bob Strickland succeeded Bob Ormsby and myself as the head of the Region 4 Vice President, Region 4 for the National Alliance of Business Running Jobs Program in the 8 Southern States.
And do you remember what year that was? I was trying to remember last night.
I think we had that responsibility first with Larry Kitchen, who had a White House appointment just like Bob Strickland did,
mm-hmm.
and called me up and asked me, told me about it. Of course, I knew that he was going to get the call. I had nothing to do with it. I had inside information in Washington, and I don't know whether he knew that or not. But and he said, I have to have somebody run the program, a regional executive, and I'm sure he must have gone through a somewhat similar thing that Bob Strickland got a call. I think it was about 1976. It could have been 77.
Wow.
We had it 3 years. I don't know, 74,
remember.
5, and 6, I think. And it's not really, it's not important at this point to do that, to determine exactly what year. But it certainly was, how did you get informed of that? Did you know? Did I talk to you?
All I can remember about that was, as Strickland says, he says, I've got this job they want me to do, and I want you to do this job with and for me.
That's exactly what Larry Kitchen said to me, and he got into it, and Bob Ormsby got into it even more. That program, as you recall, was a jobs program, unlike the Plans for Progress, which is more policy and practices and local promotion of merit employment councils. That the breakthrough period, but NAB came on with Johnson's bringing together 15 businessmen. Paul Austin was one of them. Went to the White House and he said, "I need help and want you to form this organization," which he had researched, and somebody had helped him on it. Henry Ford II was the first national chairman, and I've got all kind of interesting behind-the-scenes information about that. And Leo Beebe became the president, and I've got his transcript. This is a preliminary to asking you a question about the difference between recruiting blacks and a program that involves a pledge to hire so many economically disadvantaged people, hardcore unemployed, really people that you would not hire. And that's shocking, but that's exactly what it was. I mean, asking you to hire, Johnson was saying we need the country's 300 cities under riots and burnings, and we need something dramatic to change attitudes in this country. So we ask us to go and hire people that we just rejected legally as being not the best qualified. They were some of the least qualified. Am I summing that? The charter? That was the charter, wasn't it?
I think so.
Okay. That was a tremendous, I think we agree, I had the same reaction. Isn't it a shock that to ask American business to hire people that they could legally screen out in the employment process? That was the purpose of the program, is to hire those people who are rioting, and not those specific purposes, but to make a show nationally that we're hiring people that are among the most needy. And many of them were certainly the least qualified, and certainly we all tried to hire people that could do the job, at least be trained. When you first took over this responsibility, how did your bank react to this, bank management? Obviously, the leader says we're going to do it.
Yeah. Well, we didn't set out to hire people into jobs they couldn't do.
Right.
You know, we tried to make sure that they were jobs that they could do and could succeed at. They wasn't going to do anybody any good to put them in jobs that they were going to fail at.
Mm-hmm.
Your shareholders would be on you, and justifiably so, for doing it. So it was, I think, as much as anything, just an expression of desire and interest in trying to find a way through training and placement to bring people into the workforce who were marginal.
Okay.
I don't know that I would accept the definition that the purpose of the program was to hire people who you wouldn't hire otherwise. Maybe that's a practical expression of how it was working now. But we were just trying to find jobs within the organization that these folks could do.
Okay. But I also want to take a look at your responsibility for the South. I think at one time we had 19 NAB metros in the 8 southern states, and that there was some attrition, and when you took over there might have been a few less than that. Do you recall?
I don't remember the exact number, but those
somewhere
order of magnitude.
But you had NAB metros in each of the 8 southern states. In some cases, the bigger cities, you had more. For example, you had a NAB metro in Augusta, and Atlanta as well.
You know, I have tried to recall that, and I have very little recollection of how we dealt with the regional offices outside of Atlanta.
Did you?
I know we did.
Did you make some trips?
We made some trips, I'm sure, but it is awfully, awfully fuzzy for me.
Right.
And exactly what the programs were and what we were asking those folks to do and do with us.
Well, we had pledge cards.
Right.
And the target population was economically disadvantaged.
Right.
And President Johnson gave the whole NAB structure targets. So many by 500,000 by a certain time frame, and so many Vietnam era veterans was another target group, and ex-offenders. And we asked employers to pledge to hire those groups, and then they reported on how many they hired in each group against the national targets. That was the system, to refresh your memory on that. At the peak of my experiences on that, in 3 years, we had 3,200 employers in the 8 southern states that were pledging and reporting on that. And they worked primarily with the local state employment services. They also had money that Johnson had set up, $250 million with Congress, to support the additional training that was considered to be required to hire people that were marginally qualified. But it turned out that only a fraction of that money was spent. That was the experience that I was having. Companies didn't want the intrusion of the federal government into their plants to follow up on
the training
and that sort of thing. You got very much involved, and companies, understandably. There were a few companies like Lockheed who could deal with that, because we had federally funded training programs before, going back to the Manpower Development Training Act. But I found that a lot of employers that wanted to participate in the program and would fill out the cards, and these are the target hires, and give us good reports, they did this without federal contracts. And that was one of the criticisms of the National Alliance of Business, was that the numbers that we turned in as against the targets were not supported by government figures, but so all voluntary. I can say this, that from speaking generally, from my involvement in NAB on a national basis, that if the 3,500,000 or more hires that were reported under the NAB program, that even if a half of those were minorities and disadvantaged people that the companies would not have hired, it was a very significant change to give those people a chance in life that they probably would not have. Mm-hmm. So the overall figures weren't as important as the principle behind it, is to give people that would have difficulty as marginally qualified, I think it's a good way to look at it, a chance. And we did change the lives of a lot of people, and we know that from statistical analysis of this whole thing. Could you summarize what your experience was with this very difficult, most challenging program?
My recollection is vague. But I do know that, to the extent that the program did any good at all, it expressed the desire of senior management to put people to work. And whether or not it was, how many?
$3.5 million is the figure that's been quoted.
300,000. I'm not sure, but just going through the exercise of making the pledges and then having to say what you had done relative to those pledges, I'm sure we ended up hiring a good number of those people.
Yeah.
Whether or not those figures were absolutely accurate, probably not, but I don't think that they were bogus or intentionally misrepresented. I think people were genuinely trying to make an effort to put marginally qualified people to work.
One of the significant points of the NAB program to me is the fact that we were getting mid and small size employers, particularly throughout the South, get out of the big cities. We had exposure of to companies that certainly was a change in their attitudes towards hiring blacks. Would you agree that's a process that goes with the pledge, the commitment
right.
And
that was a worthy outcome of the program.
Right. Well, it's been questioned, but my answer to people who say, there was nobody to enforce this. Well, I think you can't presume that CEOs that commit for their companies are
they wouldn't intentionally misrepresent. I
think that's a characterization of American business that I think is prevalent, but I think it's very unfair and unrealistic. Would you add to that? How you felt about the?
I don't know that I can add anything to it. I think that's a accurate summation.
Okay. Question.
Yeah.
What I was going to show you is a four-page insert to the Lackey Southern Star, the way we publicized this whole program, mm-hmm. including an interview with Bob Ormsby. Did you have internal, did your bank, did you publicize the National Anthem?
I'm sure we did, and exactly how we did it, I can't recall.
That's the part of just bringing as many people on board as you can with the policies and the practices of the company.
Right.
And I'm sure, I would think, as you say, that it's not important that you remember it. I think that's typical, would you not say, that the companies commit to something, they try to get everybody on board.
Sure. Have to.
There'd be in staff meetings, training programs, company programs, that sort of thing. Okay. Well, I want to thank you. Wait, I think it's maybe time to break off.
I enjoyed seeing you again after all these years. I feel like you're drilling a pretty dry hole here talking to me, but
you've given us some insight as to business decision making and commitment, and that's why I'm here to get your opinion on that, and I thank you.
All right.